Mr. Katz?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I would like to start out by discussing the applicable standard. There are only two ways a losing party can vacate an arbitration award under 10A4, which is the only standard that applies here. It's the only question that came up to this Court on cert and under the exceeding powers standard. Number one, the arbitrator had no authority to interpret the contract. Or number two, the award was based not on an interpretation of the contract. Oxford cannot satisfy either of those standards here. Oxford does not dispute that the arbitrator interpreted the contract. Oxford's sole dispute here or challenge is that the arbitrator interpreted the contract incorrectly.
That's all he has to do is saying, I'm interpreting the contract and whatever he says is okay then.
Just, I mean, we were concerned in Stolt-Nielsen about a company betting the company, right, on class action whenever it agrees to arbitration, because class arbitration, will bankrupt the company and without an appeal to the court, or not much of an appeal anyway. And you're saying that, in effect, you do bet the company every time. So long as you leave it up to the arbitrator to decide whether there's a class action allowed or not, which most agreements probably do, he can find whatever he likes, right? He can find, so long as he says, I'm interpreting the agreement, it can be as wildly inconsistent with the agreement as you like, and there's nothing the courts can do about it.
Justice Scalia, Stolt-Nielsen taught us that the language of the contract or any other evidence has to demonstrate that the parties agreed to class arbitration. Stolt-Nielsen did not alter this 10A4 standard, the same standard which, before it was codified.
And you think that standard, all that standard means is that the arbitrator has to say, I am interpreting the contract, even though what he says is flatly, visibly, unquestionably contrary to what the contract says, and the court has to accept that, so long as he says, I'm interpreting the contract.
This court's jurisprudence for almost two centuries has held just exactly that.
Just exactly that.
I didn't think so. I thought it said that the award, if the award displays manifest disregard, words like that. I mean, MISCO is not absolute. MISCO has a narrow exception. And that exception is where there's just no basis in the contract for the decision. So I thought you were arguing that here, that's clearly not so. There is a basis.
Well, there is a basis. What MISCO, as I understand what MISCO teaches, is that it has to be unambiguous that the
arbitrator. No, that's a different thing. That's a different thing. It doesn't say whatever he says about the contract. He wins. It says what he says about the contract that is not just manifestly wrong. It isn't just plain language to the contrary, and et cetera. There's language in the cases to that effect. So I would be repeating myself, but are you saying there is no loophole, no matter how tiny? That's news to me.
Well, Justice Breyer, I don't think manifest disregard, certainly manifest disregard is not a standard by which this matter has come up before the court. And this Court has held in Hall Street and other cases that 10A4 is the exclusive ground set forth by Congress that this Court did not have the authority, and I'm quoting the Court, it did not have the authority to expand.
All right. Suppose I think, since I wrote the words in first options, that something like manifest disregard or totally ignoring plain law is a ground for reversing an arbitrator, even an arbitrator. Now, suppose I think that. Then do I decide against you?
No, Justice Breyer, because here both sides, not only in 2003, but in 2010 after Stolt-Nielsen, came to the arbitrator and said, we want you to decide it. They told the arbitrator at that time, look at the agreement, look at what transpired in 2002 back when this matter was in the Superior Court, and make your decision. So the arbitrator applied the law that and applied the standard that he was told to apply. He didn't just disregard it. He didn't make a decision saying, I don't care what you are telling me to do.
What supports his decision? I mean, you say that. What supports his decision that the parties here agreed? That's the standard. Did they agree to class arbitration? What supports that?
Justice Scalia, they did agree. When we were in court in 2002, Oxford represented to the state court judge there that not only are the disputes going to arbitration, but all actions regarding the disputes. And the judge specifically relied upon that, expressly relied upon that, in not sending just the disputes, but sending everything that had been asserted by Dr. Sutter, including the claims of the class. And the arbitrator —
I don't understand. There's a distinction between all disputes and all actions relating to the dispute?
Oxford made that distinction in 2002. In fact, and we point this out in our brief on page 5, the red brief, where Oxford has expressly — it's both on page 5 and page 6, and I'll refer to page 6, the top of 6. This is Oxford's counsel in 2002.
The contract — Top of page 6?
Top of page 6, Your Honor.
Yes.
Plaintiff quoted the contract here as saying that any dispute under the contract needs to be arbitrated. That's wrong. The contract says actions concerning any dispute. That was what Oxford has always argued at all times before the arbitrator. The arbitrator understood that. The arbitrator interpreted the agreement and based both on the agreement and on the representations made by Oxford as to what its own agreement meant.
But I think that's inconsistent with the law that's developed, actually, in fairness to the arbitrator, after he'd made his initial decision, which is that if you have something that just says disputes and doesn't address the issue of class arbitration at all, that you can't have class arbitration.
The arbitrator, however, Mr. Chief Justice, cannot be faulted or his award vacated based upon changes or arguments that were never made at the time. The parties made their arguments to the arbitrator. Oxford, if you will, sat on the sidelines. And this Court has also held that a party cannot sit on the sidelines, wait till the award comes down, and when it's against them, then raise new arguments for the first time. I was just going to finish saying Oxford could have raised these arguments, and maybe at the end of the day, if they raised those arguments, they would have carried the day. But I respectfully submit, as this Court has repeatedly held, that courts do not have the authority to second-guess the arbitrator and make decisions or come up with a resolution that would have been different with the arbitrator just because they disagree.
What about getting back to Justice Breyer's question? I thought his first options is fairly strong authority for him because there you have a situation with the arbitrator determining that a particular — entity or individual is bound by the agreement. And we said that's something that we will review de novo without deference. Why isn't it the same here? In other words, not everything an arbitrator says is subject to the deferential standard of review, even if he purports to say, I'm interpreting the agreement, which I think the arbitrator in first options did.
Here, Mr. Chief Justice, the arbitrator did exactly what the parties had asked him to do, though. He did not venture and do something outside of what the parties had asked him. The parties specifically presented the question to the arbitrator as to whether class arbitrations were available and specifically directed the arbitrator both to the agreement, the language in the agreement, as well as the representations and the submissions that were made below in the court system in making their respective arguments.
I thought that Oxford conceded that it did not preserve any question of entitlement to de novo review.
That is correct. Oxford has always maintained that it was the arbitrator's decision to make, and in 2010, even after Stolt-Nielsen came back to the arbitrator and asked the arbitrator to reconsider his opinion from 2003. The Oxford had never, until after losing this case, obviously, has Oxford sought the court for the first time for a de novo interpretation.
Counsel, you seem, I don't know, I see two questions here. The first was, an arbitrator exceeds his power if he decides a question is arbitral when it's not. But here there's no dispute about that, because you're right. Your adversary submitted this question to arbitration. And that's what I'm hearing you respond. He did. There's no question. He said the arbitrator has to decide this issue. Justice Breyer raised the second question. Assuming he could, is there any remaining power in the court to overturn his decision? And Justice Breyer said, if the standard is manifest disregard of fact and law, why would you still win? Because your adversary is saying the law is clear. You have to find some hook in the agreement to agree to class arbitration. And he says there's none. That's basically his position, that the arbitrator's decision on its substance manifestly disregarded the law. So that's the question that I believe is extant still.
Answering that hypothetical, assuming that there was —
Why is it a hypothetical?
Well, if there was a manifest disregard —
No, I want to say why there wasn't. I want you to explain why there wasn't one.
Well, the arbitrator did not manifestly disregard. The arbitrator did what the parties wanted the arbitrator to
do. Look, I'm going to say something, and you're going to say, oh, that's right, that's just what I wanted, and that won't do me any good if you don't think of it. The arbitrator in front of me, so you better tell me why I'm wrong, because they certainly will, and they're in the briefs. Mr. Arbitrator, this language here says all disputes will go to arbitration. It doesn't say whether they're supposed to be class, or can be, or can't be. You decide what it means. And the arbitrator thinks, all. It doesn't say. But I got to reach a decision. So what kind of a case is it? Small claims? Then it says something about court suits where they have class. Gets his magic eight ball out. And whatever it is, he says, that's what it means. It means it could include class too. Okay? Where in our case law is that a manifest disregard? He looked at the language. There were two plausible constructions. He came up with one of them. What's the problem? Now, that's, of course, their problem. But if you just say yes and don't go into why they're saying no, it's not going to help me.
Well, I don't believe that is Justice Breyer, I don't believe that is a manifest disregard.
So, nor obviously you don't.
And the reason being is that the arbitrator based his determination on the standards or the materials that were put forth before him, the agreement and the evidence, and he made a decision.
But that's not enough. As stated by Justice Breyer, he has to have come to a plausible construction. It's not enough that he said, I'm construing the contract. I have looked at the terms of the contract and what the party said, and my construction of the contract is X. That's not enough. It has to be plausible.
Okay,
Now, why is this plausible?
Well, I, with all due respect, Justice Scalia, I don't think plausibility comes into play here.
All right, use whatever word you want. Manifest disregard. Stick to the law. Now, suppose the arbitrator had said this. It doesn't say how to do it. I see how to do it. You get out a magic eight ball. Now, we would strike that down because that is not relevant. But he didn't say magic eight ball. He said class. And there are many class arbitrations. So it isn't quite magic eight ball. And you explained to me.
It's a magic eight ball. I don't know what you're
talking about. Magic eight balls, you have this. It's the non-sportsman's equivalent of throwing darts.
Why don't you concentrate on what the arbitrator himself said? Mr. Waxman said this clause wasn't unusual, but the arbitrator said, I've never seen anything like this.
Well, what, Justice Ginsburg, what the arbitrator had found was that the no civil action part of the clause was coextensive. It was completely interrelated with the mandatory arbitration provision. In other words, what the arbitrator found was that everything that was prohibited from being filed in a litigation in the court had to be arbitrated, and that was based on not
only — Can I ask you a question on something a little bit different? Did the arbitrator have — how many parties were there to this agreement? There's Oxford on one side, and how many doctors on the other side?
Well, this specific agreement was Dr. Sutter and Oxford, but there are 20,000 physicians who had signed the same agreement.
All right, so 20,000. And the effect of the arbitrator's decision is that all of those 20,000 doctors are deemed to have agreed to class arbitration, right?
Correct.
And if we assume, if I ask you to assume for the sake of argument that this agreement does not constitute an agreement to engage in class arbitration, where did the arbitrator get the authority to make that holding with respect to all of these absent class members?
Well,
they didn't agree to class arbitration. How can they, and they didn't agree to have the arbitrator decide whether the agreement calls for class arbitration. How did he purport to bind them to that decision?
Well, the arbitrator made the decision based on the language and the evidence presented before him and finding that it authorized class arbitrations. That was the determination that was made initially.
If the contract authorized it, as for Dr. Sutter, all of the others are similarly situated. They got the same contract.
They all had.
So either the contract means what the arbitrator said it meant or it doesn't. If it means what the arbitrator said it meant, then everybody's bound.
That is correct. Now, ultimately, when the matter was certified,
wait a minute. Where did he get the authority to make that decision to interpret the contract with respect to them?
Well,
saying that he can do it with respect to Oxford because Oxford agreed to have the arbitrator decide whether this calls for class arbitration. But these other people didn't. They didn't agree to have the arbitrator decide whether it calls for class arbitration.
Well, Justice Alito, this is no different than in any other contract interpretation issue. Well, the arbitrator makes a determination based upon the reading of the language and what the parties are telling him that language means.
But the difference is in first options. The one thing first option says is the question of who's going to be bound by arbitration is decided by the court de novo. And in the class context, you are binding 19,999 individuals who did not agree to be bound, depending upon the particular interpretation.
But Stolt-Nielsen, which the arbitrator faithfully reviewed, analyzed, and followed, makes clear that you can have class arbitration as long as the arbitrator determines that the contracting parties to that agreement establish that class arbitration is available.
Did these other people agree to this arbitrator? I mean, they might have said, this arbitrator, well, he's a wild guy. He's going to say that we agreed to class action. We didn't agree to class. I don't want this arbitrator. They didn't agree to this arbitrator. Why should they be bound by whatever he says?
Well, for one thing, Justice Scalia, that's exactly what Oxford wanted. Oxford argued that the class action should go into arbitration.
Could they opt out?
Well, ultimately they could opt out when it was certified. And I'd like to be clear on a point, if I may.
How could they opt out if they've agreed to class arbitration?
Well, they can opt out of class and pursue, if they wanted to at that point, an individual arbitration if that's what they chose to do.
It seems to me if they've agreed to class arbitration, they've agreed to class arbitration.
Well, they agreed for the matter to proceed as a class proceeding.
There are rules that governed that, right?
That is correct, Justice Ginsburg. That is before we get to the issue of whether the class would itself be certified.
But how could they opt out if the arbitrator says, as Justice Scalia and Justice Alito are suggesting, I've have jurisdiction to decide this case. I decide that there is a class action. All these people are in the class.
Justice Kennedy, the determination that this matter could proceed as a class arbitration was only the first issue that was decided. We then engaged in the procedural mechanism by which the matter could be certified.
Well, presumably they could opt out, but did they agree to be bound by this unless they opted out? That's not the usual way people are bound by litigations.
But everyone, Justice Alito, everyone signs the same agreement. And therefore, if the arbitrators are going to make a determination,
no, but I think you're not accepting my assumption that this is an incorrect interpretation of the contract. That's the assumption. This is incorrect. If we were reviewing this as an appellate court reviewing the interpretation of the contract under Stolt-Nielsen, we would say this is wrong. This is really wrong. Okay, assume that to be the case. Then how are these absent people bound? And it's really not an answer to say, well, they can opt out. If they didn't agree to be bound by this arbitrator's decision, then they didn't agree to be bound absent by opting out, which is an unusual procedure for being bound by an agreement.
You could never have class action arbitration if that were so.
It would not be
impossible because you could never get in advance. I mean, they find out that by getting notice, and then they decide whether they want to stay with it or opt out.
Well, in any class arbitration, the arbitrator is not going to decide the same questions as to the 20,000 of the same agreements. It's decided based upon the class representative who brings the matter. And even if the arbitrator was wrong, Justice Alito, I submit that under 10A4 and the applicable standard, that even in Concepcion, this Court said 10A4 is not an issue of mistake. It's an issue of misconduct. And that's not what we have here. If there was a mistake, that still would not be enough with respect for the courts to have vacated the arbitrator's determination on this matter.
I'm not sure it's relevant, but it might be. I thought the purpose of arbitration was to decide these things quickly. This has been going on 11 years, right?
This has been going on 11 years. That is true.
It's not a facetious question because I think one of the concerns about class arbitration is that it eliminates the supposed benefits of arbitration because you can't have sort of quick and rough and ready determinations when it's going to bind 20,000 people.
Well, class arbitration is, as in many arbitrations in this day and age, involves complex issues that sometimes you have major corporations doing battle over major agreements that they know at the time involve big ticket items.
Let me ask you this question because I think it's consistent with the answer you're giving to the Chief Justice. A little bit different, though. Suppose you have, and this is a hypothetical case. This is not this case, so I don't know the fact of it. Suppose you have an attorney in a small town, well-respected, doesn't have a great big practice, and he's chosen as the arbitrator. And if he arbitrates the one case, he's going to get a fee of, I don't know, $10,000. He says, you know, if this is a class arbitration, I can keep this going for 11 years, I will make $1 million. Does he have the obligation to say, I'm going to decide the class action issue under this theory that was decided here? And after I do that, since I have a conflict, I'll bow out. I'll just say there is a class action, then I'll leave it for some other arbitrator. Does he have that obligation? And if he doesn't, should that bear on our decision here?
Justice Kennedy, that should not bear on the decision here because this matter comes up under 10A4. If there were questions about the partiality of the arbitrator, that I want to rule in favor of Katz because I want to prolong this thing as long as possible, then perhaps Oxford should have brought the matter under 10A2.
How long? Can we straighten out this 11 years? How many years was this in the New Jersey courts before there was ever an arbitrator appointed?
Well, the matter wasn't in the New Jersey courts for that long, but various points in time, because the AAA rules allow for a filing of a federal suit to vacate, Oxford on multiple occasions.
But tell me why is that a factor or not a factor in our decision? That should not be a factor in our decision?
Partiality is not a factor, Justice Kennedy,
well, but surely
in this decision.
I'm sorry, finish your answer.
In this decision, because partiality, or what could potentially be perceived as a subjective intent of so the arbitrator does not play under 10A4. And if I may
but
add.
Under that provision, the partiality provision, is addressed to favoring one party as opposed to another party. I think Justice Kennedy's question goes to an institutional concern about an arbitrator making a decision of this sort that goes not to partiality between parties, but a problem about the way the system would work that would create an incentive for an arbitrator, implicit or explicit, to reach a ruling that expands his authority.
Well, arbitrators, I would submit that an arbitrator who was doing something that was documented or perceived to be crazy, and pardon my vernacular, or just way out of line, well, then I submit that arbitrator is not going to be hired again.
What is the history of class actions in arbitration? There are at least enough of them so that the AAA has a set of rules about how you handle class arbitrations, right?
That's correct. I think it's important if I could just address a couple of points regarding that.
How many have there been? Have there been dozens, hundreds, thousands?
Well, I don't know.
Do you have any idea?
I don't think there have been thousands, but I know there have certainly been a number so far that the American Arbitration Association has set forth rules. And
I'm sure there's been a number. What's the number?
I don't know the number.
It could be less than 100.
I wouldn't know that, Justice Scalia. But if I may point this out, class arbitrations were certainly in existence at the time that this matter was sent into class arbitration. And, in fact, I think it's also worthy to understand that when I brought this matter in Superior Court, I argued that the class action should be kept in court. But it was Oxford's argument that everything, including the class action, go into arbitration. It was Oxford's interpretation of its own clause that the arbitrator relied upon, which puts this case completely outside of Stolt-Nielsen, where in Stolt-Nielsen, the arbitrator fashioned their own rule based on some policy preference about class actions, which wasn't present here. And if I could address an issue that was raised about that the arbitrator discussed something was bizarre. In 2003, prior to Stolt-Nielsen, the arbitrator expressly disavowed that in his 2010 opinion. And he made it very clear that he based his decision on the interpretation of the agreement as well as the representations made as to what that agreement meant to the court system. I think this court has recognized for two centuries that an arbitrator's error in law of fact cannot be the grounds for a vacator.
I'm sorry to just interrupt. For most of that two centuries, courts refused to enforce arbitration agreements. That's the whole reason we have the FAA.
But here, both sides, Mr. Chief Justice, expressly asked the arbitrator. This is not a question of arbitrability, because both sides wanted the arbitrator to make that decision. Then even after 2010, when it came to light that Basel, it was a plurality, and the issue of whether it's a question of arbitrability is an open question. Oxford didn't go running to court then. Instead, it went back to the arbitrator and said, we want you to reconsider your 2003 decision. And the arbitrator again went through the analysis of interpreting the agreement and the representations made by the parties about what that agreement meant. I submit we have to, if we trust arbitrators to handle such important issues as civil rights issues and other very important matters of singular importance, we have to expect that they will follow the precepts of this court and the FAA as to what constitutes grounds for class arbitration. I think the Third Circuit should be affirmed if there are no other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Katz.